So I'm going to recap some of the discussion that Rob gave this morning, but maybe in a slightly bit more detail, and with a little bit more of motivation. So I want to think about two separated systems, S1, S2, and an experiment that's going to start. So time's going this way. Experiment starts at some point, ends at some later point. And I want to arrange things so that the separation is large enough that no signal, no light signal, can have got from S1 at or after the start of the experiment to S2 before the end of the experiment, and vice versa. So if that holds, then at least during the experiment, S1 and S2 are isolated in the strongest sense that physics allows us. There's just no possibility of anything about the state of S1 influencing that of S2 during the experiment, or vice versa. Nor is there any time for any measurement outcome on S1 that results from, say, Alice here carrying out a measurement to be sent across to Bob, who's doing the experiment on S2, even if she wants to, even if she's trying her hardest to get data out of S1 and help Bob out by telling him what it is. There's just not time for it to go across. So all the information that Alice is going to have throughout her experiment is encoded by the reduced density matrix, rho one, which is given by tracing out the quantum degrees of freedom of Bob's system, and vice versa. And we could check just by looking at how these reduced density matrices change when Bob, for instance, applies a unitary or Bob carried out a measurement. We look at how rho one changes, and we see that neither applying a unitary on S2 nor carrying out a measurement affects the value of rho one. So operations over here, whatever they are, don't change the density matrix, which encodes all the physical information available about the system over here. In other words, operations on entangled subsystems, as long as they're separated, space-like separated throughout the time period of these operations, don't give us any way of superluminal signaling. It's in this sense that quantum mechanics already seems to have some sort of residual trace of the structure of quantum field theory in it. You can imagine theories that are rather like quantum mechanics, but don't have anything like this property, that do allow signaling, for instance, by carrying out measurements on one system, in such a way that you affect the result of the other. But particular unitary laws and the measurement postulates of quantum mechanics don't allow that. And so quantum mechanics already has within it a structure that's ready to be made compatible with special relativity. So sorry for the people who've just come in. Two things. I welcome questions and interruptions, and I apologize that I was asked at rather short notice, so the slides are a little rougher than I'd like. But that should only motivate questions even more. So are there any yet? Okay. So let's let me try and get this thing to move forward. So if we take the classic example that Rob mentioned in his lecture this morning of a singlet state, whatever root 2 up, down, minus down, up, shared between space-like separated parties A and B, and we ask what happens to the joint state of those that they share if Bob measures sigma 3, the spin in which these are eigenstates. Well, with probability half, Bob gets outcome up. And the joint state afterwards, according to Bob's calculation, is down up. Probability half, Bob gets outcome down. And the joint state is up down. And if Alice knows Bob's going to do that, but doesn't know what outcome he gets, then her best description of the joint state is given by this density matrix, which is a probabilistic mixture with equal weights of that and that. And her best description of what she's controls, the reduced density matrix, is just given by tracing over Bob's state here. That's this, up, up, plus down, down, which is the uniformly mixed state. Let's try and deal with that. So that just confirms what we've already expected from quantum theory. Bob's measurement gives Alice no information, conveys no superluminal signal. And yet, that happens despite the fact that their outcomes are correlated. In fact, perfectly correlated or perfectly anti-correlated if they both choose to measure the same spin observable. Sorry, this thing is not cooperating. Let me try it here. Okay, so just to summarize, there's the state. They both measure SZ, and after doing that, after one SZ measurement, the joint state is either this or this, but not both parties know that. After a second SZ measurement, well, the outcome is determined, although the person on the right who's carrying out that second measurement doesn't know which way it's determined in advance, and the probability of anti-correlation is 1. And if they carry out measurements along different axes rather than the same axes, well, then you get a slightly less trivial calculation. So here's the singlet, and one of the neat features of the singlet is that whichever spin basis you write it in, it has the same form. So this is, let's take the basis A instead of Z. We could write the singlet like this, up A, down A, minus down A, up A. If we measure spin about the A axis on the left, well, with probability half, we get this outcome, and with probability half, we get this one. If we measure about B on the right, well, now there's something non-trivial. Both possibilities can happen. And the probabilities depend on the angle theta between the two axes, A and B. And the probability of getting anti-correlation is now this expression, and we can write that in various ways, all of which are sometimes convenient, which again just depend on the vectors A and B. So, as Rob was trying to persuade us this morning, there's no superluminal signaling here, but there's at least at first sight, an intuition that something in nature is doing something that looks rather like superluminal signaling. If we take into account the measurement on one side, the joint quantum state, which affects both parties, one thinks, and the reduced density matrix on the other side, do change if we take account of the measurement outcome, according to elementary quantum mechanics. So that led APR in a different example. I've chosen this one because it's more suitable for actually going on to producing Dell's theorem. But it led APR to ask, is there something that quantum mechanics isn't telling us that is actually there in physical reality? So they offered an argument in the paper which relies really on two assertions, or two hypotheses. If you had a complete theory, and the question we're leaving it as an open question whether quantum mechanics is such a theory, then everything that's there in nature, every element of physical reality, should be represented in the theory. There should be something in the mathematics of the theory corresponding to everything that's there. And how do you tell what is or isn't there? Well, they gave another criterion for that. Here's at least a sufficient condition, they suggest. If you've got a system and you could tell with certainty the value that you're going to get by carrying out a measurement without in any way disturbing that system, so you know for sure what the outcome of the measurement will be, that must be because there's an element of physical reality corresponding to that. If you know for sure what the system's going to do, you know that there is something in nature that's already there. There's a fact of the matter, and you know what that fact is going to be when you carry out the measurement. So, EPRs, there's nothing self-evident about EPR's criteria, but there's nothing ridiculous about them either. And if you follow through the discussion of spin measurements on the singlet, they tell us something rather strong that quantum theory certainly doesn't imply. So they tell us that the outcomes of every possible spin measurement about every axis on both sides should be predetermined before any measurements are carried out on either side. In EPR's language, there must be elements of physical reality that should be there in a complete theory, telling you what the outcome of measuring sigma dot n on the left would be for any spin axis n, and similarly here. Why so? Well, we've already seen. You start with the singlet. If you were to measure SZ on the left, you'll either get that or that. If the state is this, you know for certainty what the result of measuring SZ on the right will be. And if the state's this, again, you know for certainty what the result will be. In one case it's down, in the other case it's up. So you can carry out a measurement on the left, and as a result of doing that, you know for sure something about this system, which you never measured, never touched. So it seems as though, by at least a common sense definition of disturbing a system, we can tell what the outcome of the measurement on the right for this particular value of spin, as said, will be without in any way disturbing it. And so there should be an element of physical reality corresponding to the value of the spin on the right, for about the spin about the z-axis on the right. So of course, I could have run that argument the other way around, for the right, carry out the measurement on the right, and that would determine the outcome on the left. And I could have run it not just for the sigma z, but for any spin axis. So, and these are all things one could do. So the argument runs, I could carry out a measurement on the left, and if I did, I'd be able to infer the outcome on the right. Therefore, there should be an element of physical reality corresponding to the outcome on the right. But that conclusion doesn't require me actually carry out the measurement on the left. So we end up with, starting with the EPR criteria, and ending up with the conclusion that all spin values about all axes for both particles should be determined in a complete theory. And they're certainly not determined in quantum mechanics, so that suggests that quantum mechanics isn't a complete theory, and maybe that there is a more complete underlying theory. And then 30 years go by. John Bell writes his beautiful and celebrated paper. People get to work and simplify his arguments. Klauser, Horn, Shimoni, Holt, who were mentioned this morning, produce a simpler version that's more amenable to experimental test. Another 20 years go by. And in a very, very nice paper, Lucien Hardy produces perhaps the simplest way of understanding Bell inequalities and understanding the implications of the EPR argument for pairs of measurements on the quantum singlet. So let's just suspend disbelief for the moment. Suppose EPR are correct. Suppose that the outcomes of every possible measurement we could carry out on the left and the right are actually sitting there somehow encoded in nature. They're predetermined. And let's just focus on a couple of measurements we could carry out on the left. We call them A1 and A2, which have outcomes, and let's normalize so that our outcomes are plus or minus one. And by hypothesis, if EPR are right, those outcomes are predetermined. So anytime we make a singlet, actually there's more information than we're aware of, and it includes the values A1 and A2 on the left. And similarly, so let's take another pair of measurements on the right, big B1 and big B2. Well, it includes the values, the predetermined values of the outcomes for those spin measurements as well. So we've made the singlet. By hypothesis, these numbers are attached to the two particles in the singlet. And we could just ask in the abstract, even though we can't directly measure all these numbers, you can ask, well, could it be the case that A2 equals B2? Perhaps it could. That A1 doesn't equal B2. So I want equality to be represented by this solid line and inequality to be represented by the dotted lines here. But of course, remember, there are only two possible outcomes. So there are only two possibilities. Either these numbers are equal or they're opposite. So we could list, for instance, this set of four questions. Could it be the case that those two are unequal, and those two are unequal, and those two are unequal, and those two are equal? And clearly, the answer can't be yes to all four of those. If this doesn't equal this, well, and this doesn't equal this, well, then A1 has to equal A2. And now A1 doesn't equal B2 because of this line. So A2 has to be not unequal to B2. But then it can't be the case that A2 equals B2, which is what this line is telling us. So we can get three yeses. And if you think a little harder, you can see you can get three yeses or you can get one yes. You can't get four yeses. You can't get zero yeses. And in fact, you can't get two yeses either. But we're most interested in the fact that you can't push beyond three here. So we've got a little problem, which is our hypothesis was that there's some predetermined value for one spin measurement here and for a different possible spin measurement here. And we can't carry out both of them. We've got nothing in the EPR argument told us that quantum mechanics is wrong about the fact that you can't measure non-commuting quantities. It's perfectly reasonable to think that measuring this one will disturb the value of that one. So we can't directly look at all the numbers and just check. But what we can do is take one of these four pairs. We could carry out one measurement over here and one measurement over here. And if we choose randomly, then, well, since at most three, we can get at most three yeses. If we choose a completely random pair, we've got a probability at most three quarters of getting a yes answer. And more generally, well, you can get three yeses or one yeses, but not zero or four. So in fact, we could show something slightly stronger. The probability of yes is separated from a half by no more than a quarter, if EPR are right, and if these outcomes are predetermined. So what does quantum theory tell us? Depends on the measurements. But for instance, if we choose this convenient set of measurements in which we, on the left, we're measuring spin about the z-axis and, say, the x-axis, or something that's separated by pi from the z-axis. And on the right, we're choosing measurements about this axis, which is halfway between these two, so separated by pi over 4. And I'm sorry, that angle is pi over 2. So these two are separated by pi over 2. This one from here by pi over 4, and this one here by pi over 4. And the alternative choice on the right is separated again by pi over 4, but the other side of this one. Well, we had a general formula for the probability of getting these things to be anti-correlated from quantum mechanics. It just depends on the sine of half the angle of separation. So we could plug that in, and in fact we find all the probabilities for all our questions take the same value, which ends up as cos squared pi over 8, like that. So we get, and numerically that's half 1 plus 1 over root 2, and we get a probability of 0.853 of getting a yes answer for this particular choice of pairs of measurements. And obviously that's larger than 3/4. And not obviously, but with a little more work, one could show that's in fact the largest possible number that you can get, the largest possible probability of yes, for any two input, two output tests of this sort. So that's the result. I haven't really got time to cover it here, but it's known as Cyril's unbound. That is, one could give more than one interesting lecture just on that point itself. Why does nature allow things that that violate the EPR criterion up to a point, but no further? Where do these bounds come from? Do they just come from the structure of quantum mechanics, or is there some deeper reason for them? But for the moment, let's just worry about EPR and quantum mechanics and what we can infer. Well, we've got a clear gap now between the EPR criteria and the quantum mechanical prediction. We can ask what experiment says, but before we do that, maybe we should notice that we can actually test something a little more general than the EPR argument and the conclusions of the EPR argument. We can test the idea that there could exist local hidden variables, so-called local hidden variables, determining the outcomes of measurements on space-like separated systems. So the idea here is that something in a more complete theory allows one to say everything, or perhaps even only something, more than quantum mechanics about the outcomes of measurements. What? Well, we're not going to commit to the form of that theory. So we're just going to assume there's some variables, and let's write it as a vector lambda, which is a list of scalars, lambda 1 to lambda n. And the intuitive picture is at the source here, when you create what you think you're creating a singlet, you're actually creating something that's a singlet carrying extra data that we don't know how to measure directly. But we can encode abstractly as a list of variables like this. So this particle carries those data away, and we may as well, it costs us nothing to assume that both particles share the same data. If they don't, the argument follows through anyway, so let's assume they do. And the hypothesis then that we want to test, which is going to disagree with quantum mechanics, is that there is some way of writing the outcome for a measurement of sigma dot A in a way that depends on this choice of spin axis, A, and these variables, lambda, and similarly for B. And crucially, the hypothesis that we need to make is that whatever the algorithm is for calculating this thing, it doesn't depend on the measurement choice that's made over here. So the intuition, which we're going to need to probe a bit further, is that this measurement choice is something that's been put in maybe very close to the time that we do the experiment here. And so there can't have been time for that information to have got across here and affect this calculation, and likewise the other way around. Okay. So a little more thought shows us that we don't actually need a deterministic algorithm to calculate these things. We we can run through an argument in which there's only a probabilistic prediction of A of A and lambda and B of B lambda without even altering our notation. And the reason for that is, intuitively, if you think of this particle going over here, carrying lambda and carrying a dice that it's going to roll to allow it to decide which way to jump along with A lambda, and this one doing the same. In terms of everything we're going to write down, it's not going to matter whether the dice are rolled here and here, or whether they were already rolled back here. So we might as well just encode the dice outcomes as variables tacked on to our vector lambda, and assume that anything that's going to be probabilistically determined in our model is probabilistically determined back at the source here. Okay. So everything we said about the disagreement between EPR's conclusions and quantum mechanics holds for this more general hypothesis of probabilistic local hidden variables. And now we can get back to the question of what does experiment tell us? Well, here's one now quite venerable but famous and beautiful experiment by Alain Aspect. The idea here is that the measurement choice is made by a sort of pseudo-random number generator. The path that the photon goes along depends on whether it hits a water wave at a point where it's at the peak of its amplitude or some other point in its oscillation. And it can go to this way, in which case it's measured about one axis, or this way, in which case it's measured about another. And there's another water wave that's oscillating very fast here. And the idea, the intuition is or was, that it's reasonable to treat these water waves as effectively local random number generators, because physical intuition suggests to us they have nothing whatsoever to do with a source of photons that's separated from both of them. And so although in principle the behavior of the water waves is predictable, it should not be predictable by anything encoded in any physical theory that's describing variables carried away from here and here. Well, one could worry about that. One should worry about that. But it's certainly a beautiful way of testing a lot of the intuitions, and it gives, of course, predictions completely in line with quantum mechanics and far away from the alternative predictions given by local hidden variable theories. Well, there's a... People, both experimentalists and theorists, who are interested in these questions, really, really, really want to nail down for sure the quantum theory is correct, that its predictions are right and the predictions of local hidden variable theories are wrong. And so there's been an awful lot of work put in by both theorists and experimentalists, but especially experimentalists, trying to eliminate as far as possible any loopholes in the argument that takes us from a given experiment to the conclusion that we've verified quantum mechanics and definitively excluded local hidden variables. And the most recent culmination of that line of thought has been a number of papers, of which this was the first, describing beautiful experiments, if time allows, I'll say a bit more about them, that are purportedly loophole-free in demonstrating quantum mechanics is right, EPR, local hidden variables are wrong.
So, what was the loophole in the
Aspect paper? So I sort of glibly said, actually there's more than one loophole, and I was going to describe them later, but thanks for the question, let's do it now. So I glibly said, well, it's reasonable to treat the behavior of the water waves here as a random number generator that's locally generating random numbers, determining what measurements carried out on the photons here and here, because physical intuition suggests that nothing about the way nothing about the creation of these photons depends on or is sensitive in any way to the behavior of these water waves. Nonetheless, the fact is the water waves are perfectly deterministic. They oscillate.
If that's not true, don't you have an even greater nominal value? You have something about the state of the water waves that's encoded in your particles that are being emitted.
But the second part of what you said is right. For that loophole to be exploited, some sort of information about the way the water waves are behaving would have to be available to the physics that creates the photons here. But does it have to be non-local? No, it doesn't. So look, I was just going to say what the water waves are like. There's sort of regions of at peak amplitude, high density and low density. So when a photon comes in like this, it refracts and comes out at one angle. And at zero amplitude, the density is just uniform. So the photon follows a different path. And the oscillation just goes perfectly predictably forever. Or for as long as the experiment runs. So it might seem contrived and implausible, but you could certainly write down some sort of cooked up theory that says once you set up a cell with water waves with this behaving like this over here, something submicroscopic carries information about that cell over here, not at faster than light speed, but just once the thing's been set up, the information percolates over here, and the source becomes aware of that, and now it knows, aha, I see. So at some time zero, when the information was sent to me, the water wave was like that, and I know the frequency. Well, now it's time like that here, and by the time, if I send a photon out now, it will reach the cell again at this time, and so I know exactly what the amplitude of the water wave will be when the photon that I'm going to send reaches the cell, and so I know whether it's going to go this way, or perhaps not be detected at all, a bit somewhere between the two. So the information, in principle, if you're willing to produce a completely ad hoc theory, you can arrange things so that the information about which measurement is going to be carried out over here is available to the source here, and the information about the measurement that we carry out here is also available to the source, and that violates the assumptions of the Bell inequality.
That assumes the state of the where you are in the amplitude is encoded in the emission.
Right. It assumes. Yeah, so it assumes that some all sorts of weird stuff is happening at a level invisible to us, which is carrying quite detailed information away from, say, from things like water cells to sources in such a way that, and not only is the information available, but it's somehow exploited, so the sources actually prepare photons to go. Prepare photons in advance, knowing what measurement is going to be carried out on them. So, is that plausible? I would have said not. But is it a loophole in principle? It is.
Are there others? You said there were. I don't want to completely derail talk.
No, that's fine. So here, there is another one. This one is called the locality loophole. The question is whether the measurements that are going to be carried out on one wing actually could, in principle, be not information that's available to the particle on the other wing. The other one that's commonly discussed is the so-called detector efficiency loophole. So I've sort of blithely presented things here as though every pair of photons goes through and actually gets measured and produces an answer.
Probability for detection.
But actually, especially in these early experiments, the probability for detection was quite low. And you can rig up a theory in which the photon decides whether or not it's going to be detected, depending whether the sort of measurement that it likes the look of is being made on it or not. So you have to... I'm getting ahead of myself here. But to get around that, well, you have two choices. One is just to make a theoretical assumption, which is that the stuff that's actually detected is truly representative of everything else. That's the so-called fair sampling assumption. And the other is to try and design experiments in which your detection efficiency is high enough that this loophole ceases to be there. So, I have two directions I can go in. I could say more about this experiment and the loopholes and the extent to which they got around them, and maybe one other loophole. Or I could say more about bell-like inequalities in GH, the Greenberg-Horn-Zeilinger state, which was touched on this morning. Does anybody have a preference one way or the other? Experiments or maths? Maths.
I think it's
going to
be maths.
Right. So let's do that. Okay, so I just wanted to mention a couple of extensions of the Bell inequalities in different directions. One possibility, of course, is instead of thinking of two possible measurements that you could carry out for a pair of particles, you have a larger number. For instance, we could have n measurements on each side. And we could run through exactly the same argument I gave for GHZ to produce an inequality that covers this case. So now we're using the same notation, so dotted lines are unequal, solid lines are equal. We could ask, is it possible for all of these relations to hold? This is not equal to this, which is not equal to this, et cetera, all the way down to this, which is equal to this. And it's pretty clear, there's an odd number of dotted lines here. So if you follow the dotted lines, these two should be unequal if all the dotted line relations hold. But the solid line says they should be equal. So this has got to break down somewhere. It only has to break down for one of them, but it has to break down for at least one of them. So, and there are two n relations here. So if we arrange things so that we randomly choose to test one of these relations, say A3 and B3, well, one of them holds, we don't know which. If we make a completely random choice among them, the probability of getting a no has to be larger than equal to 1 over 2n. But again, we can play around in quantum mechanics and look at various choices. And if we take the most symmetric choice, which is actually also a simple generalization of the choice we made for GHZ, in which the measurements on the left are about spin axes that are each separated by this angle, theta, which is pi over n. So they rotate all the way down to here, and this last angle, again, is pi over n. And the ones on the right are almost the same, but offset by half that number. So that's pi over 2n, and then another pi over n, and another pi over n, and so on. Then the probability of any one of these inequalities being violated is, well, this number. I've just written it down for one pair, but it's true for every pair. And the key thing here is that it's of order 1 over n squared rather than 1 over n. So quantum mechanics predicts asymptotically much stronger anticorrelations than local hidden variables and the EPR argument. This turns out to be enormously useful in cryptography. It's there's an almost perfect failure. The anti-correlations in quantum mechanics are almost perfect. So any deviation from anti-correlation is detectable almost certainly, up to 1/n², we can make n as large as we like. And that means you've got a way of telling almost for sure whether or not two parties are actually sharing a singlet. And once you've got that, you've got a way of verifying almost for sure that if they carry out measurements on that thing that you have, that is almost certainly a singlet, about the same axes, they will get perfectly anti-correlated answers that nobody else can get information about. So, which means you could show with near certainty that they can share a secure string of bits that they both have and no eavesdropper can have any information about. So let me, again, there's a lot one can say about that, but let me just turn to the GHZ discussion. It's astonishing in hindsight how long it took. This was another 25 years after Bell's 64 paper. Here's the Greenberger-Horn Zeilinger state. It's a tripartite system, three qubits, and just about the simplest generalization you can imagine of the singlet state. So up, 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 minus down, down, down. If you look at that state, you could verify a few simple facts. Let's not go through the pain of doing it, but just be clear that we could. So first, look, here's three operators. Sigma x acting on the first particle, sigma y on the second, sigma y on the third, tensed together. And a similar thing with x now on the second, and a similar thing with x on the third. Well, you could work out the commutator of any pair of those, and it's you can see straight away from the commutation relations of the Pauli matrices that they commute. So, for instance, this one times this one is the same as the reverse. Okay, we didn't even need the state to verify that. We can also check that the state I wrote down is a joint eigenstate of all three of those things. Well, again, all you need to do is simply write down the Pauli matrices in the Z basis, look at the action of that on this thing, and see that you get the same thing. So it's an eigenstate of this, and with eigenvalue plus one, and also this, and also this. And here's a fourth operator, which is the tensor product of three sigma x's. We could do a similar calculation and check that it's an eigenstate of this one as well, with eigenvalue minus one. You can either write down the matrices again, or you can notice that this thing is just minus the product of these, and we already calculated the eigenvalues of these three. Okay. So now, GHZ's version of the EPR argument tells us, well, we suppose we were able to prepare a system in this state. We know the eigenvalue of the operator sigma x1 tensor sigma y2 tensor sigma y3. So if we were to measure sigma x1 on particle 1 and sigma y2 on particle 2, we know without carrying out the measurement what the value of sigma y3 on particle 3 must be. We get plus or minus 1 here, we get plus or minus 1 here, and we know that the product of these three things has to equal plus 1. So we can infer this value from the outcomes of these two. And the EPR argument tells us that means there should be an element of physical reality determining this thing because we can infer for sure the outcome of a measurement without doing anything to this system. We only carry out measurements on this one and this one. And, well, as before, of course, there's nothing special about particle 3. We could have run this for particle 2 and particle 1. And we had a whole set of operators we could look at, four of them, in fact. So we end up with the conclusion that there's an element of physical reality corresponding to the outcome that we would get if we measured sigma x1 or sigma y1 on on particle 1, and similarly sigma x2 or sigma y2 on particle 2, and similarly sigma x3 or sigma y3 on particle 3. So let's give those things name. These are just numbers. These are the outcomes we would get if we did carry out those measurements. Let's call them M1x if it's sigma 1x and so on. So M1x, M2x, M3x, M1y, M2y, M3y, and these are just each plus or minus one. The argument doesn't tell us their values, but it tells us they should exist. So if we measure this tensor product, well, we'd have to get this product. Each of these outcomes is determined. So the product operator has a determined outcome, this one. Similarly this, similarly this, similarly this. So we get four equations, three with plus ones on the right and one with minus one. And now you notice there's a direct contradiction here. On the one hand, mx1, mx2, mx3 is minus one from the fact that we know the eigenvalue of this operator. So we have this relation. But on the other hand, if you multiply out this and this and this, well, you get, for instance, my2 squared, so that's plus one, and my3 squared, that's plus one, and my1 squared, that's plus one. And what's left is just mx1, mx2, mx3. So that tells us that the product of those three, which is plus one, is mx1, mx2, mx3. And, well, we can't have both of them. And yet the EPR argument tells us we must have both of them. Okay. There's a lot more that one could say. I think it's important. A lot of people's intuitions, when they're trying to sort of reach beyond what we know about entanglement and try and say something about other areas of physics, a lot of people's intuitions are based just on the properties of the singlet. And I think it's important to be clear that multipartite entanglement is much richer than bipartite. That, as Rob stressed this morning, you don't need a maximally entangled state to get non-local Bell correlations and violations of Bell inequalities. Any pure entangled state will work. And there are many different ways of separating the predictions of quantum theory from the predictions of local hidden variables. I've only touched on a few here. So, other questions at this point? I could wrap up, or I could say more about loopholes, but I think I'm running out of time. I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to talk for 45 minutes or 60. Is anybody clear? If it's 60, then I'll... Well, let me first take questions. If there are any questions, and then I will. Yeah.
Are there bounds on these sort of measures of correlation coming just from causality? So just saying you kind of superimposing it, signaling. So this quantity is less than this, and then quantum mechanics is this. And then this 0.853.
Yeah.
So how does quantum mechanics compare to the maximal?
Yeah. Thank you. Do you sort of know the answer already, or? Sort of. So there's a very, very nice seminal paper by Sandu Popescu and Daniel Röhrlich. So let's not commit ourselves to any particular theory. And in particular, let's not assume that quantum mechanics is necessarily right. But just imagine that we're doing things like Bell experiments so that you can input a choice here to this thing. Let's suppose this is a black box. So the black box is going to represent our experiment. You turn a dial, and that's your measurement choice. And the box produces an output. So that's our model of the outcome of the experiment. And over here, you could do the same thing. And this box will produce an output. So we're not going to assume that these boxes are deterministic, and we're not going to assume necessarily that they follow quantum mechanics. We can ask, what constraint on Bell inequalities do we get if we assume only one thing, which is, however you separate these boxes, and whatever choices you make, there's no way for you to send some sort of signal in which something about the output of this box, perhaps given some particular choice, allows you to infer something about what was input over here. So if you assume only no superluminal signaling. And the answer is that, so we saw probability of local hidden variables of, let me write the word yes as shorthand for getting one of the four equations we had to be correct, that is less than or equal to 3/4. Probably quantum mechanics, getting yes, is less than or equal to 0.85, etc. The probability of, in no signaling world, of getting a yes, actually is unconstrained. You can arrange perfect anti-correlation in no signaling world. So if I can remember how to do that, let me flip back to the actual tests. Okay, so how am I going to do this? So the boxes behave such that if A1 and B1 are input, the outputs are, well, they're always going to be unequal. And half the time they're going to be one way around, and half the time they're going to be other way around. So they're plus one, minus one, or minus one, plus one, with probability of half each. And so the rules of the game here are, I don't have to give you any mechanism, I just have to tell you what the boxes do, and then you have to go away and see, is there any way of sending signals given more because they behave like this? Okay, so I just need to tell you what they do for the other three pairs. Well, they behave similarly. So if A2, B2 are input, again, the outputs are perfectly anti-correlated. With probability of half each. And if A2B1 are input, same story. And if the last pair are input, then they're perfectly correlated with probability a half each for both of the possibilities. So if A2 and B2 are input, the outputs are +1, +1, -1, -1. So clearly, if you have boxes that behave like this, whatever pair of questions you ask, for instance, this one, you'll get the answer yes. There's always a perfect anticorrelation for the first three. There's always a perfect correlation for the fourth. So the probability of getting a yes clearly equals one. What you need to check is that whatever your input is on the left, the probability distribution of the outcomes on the right is the same. But actually, if you look at this for a moment, that is almost self-evident. If I input A1 on the left, well, what can be happening here? If I measure A1 and B1, then with probability half, the output on the right will be -1, and with probability half, it's +1. If I measure instead A1, B2, sorry, I must have written. That should have been an A1, B2. If I measure A1 on the left and B2 on the right, well, the probability of getting the outcome for B2, the one on the right, is still a half for -1 and a half for +1. And similarly for any other input on the left, the probabilities of the outputs for either input on the right are equal. And similarly, of course, for any input on the right, the probabilities of the outputs are here, are equal. So no experiment, so to speak, that you can carry out on the left. In other words, no input, since that's all you can do with these boxes, you put it on the left, will give you any information about what happened on the right. All you're going to get is +1 with probability half, -1 probability half. As long as you're only looking at one of the boxes, it might as well just be flipping a coin, and that's all you're going to learn from. So there's no superlumen of signaling, and yet we've got a stronger guarantee correlation than quantum mechanics allows. So there are various lines of thought about that. One is this is a deep mystery that tells us that we need to understand some principle that picks out quantum mechanics and the particular strength of anticorrelations that quantum mechanics allows from the more general space of no signaling theories, which allow stronger anticorrelations. Another line of thought is, well, this is it's a sort of interesting mathematical observation, but we haven't really got a full physical theory here. We've just got a toy model involving boxes. And there's an awful lot of structure to quantum mechanics. And to isolate on this particular number and argue that it's something that in itself, without thinking about the whole structure of quantum theory, needs a singular and compelling explanation, is maybe asking, we're going to ask the question, all right, but one shouldn't necessarily expect a compelling answer. I don't know, I'm fairly agnostic myself on that. It's certainly an interesting line of research, and there's been an awful lot of work on the no signaling theories and generally the question of how far you can push things from this toy model with boxes to at least slightly more realistic theories that allow you to talk about many boxes and something that plays the role of unitary operations that allows boxes to interact and so on. More questions? Can I steal 2 minutes of your time then, just to say one final thing? So we mentioned a couple of loopholes. Here's another one that you might worry about. Think of any of the experiments we've described so far. You have a source of photons, let's say. You have something like filters and multipliers that are set to do measurements. And what typically happens is that these things produce quite small electrical pulses, and the pulses go along wires, and then some counter correlates them. And eventually, you get something like a printout or a larger signal, the coincidence counter here. So we're not forced, of course, to take the view that there's something like a genuine collapse in quantum theory, but it's a venerable line of thought about quantum theory, and we can't exclude it. And we're looking for loopholes anyway. So let's take that view for the moment. I suppose that there's some transition from potential outcomes encoding the wave function to actual measurements at some collapse point, and we're uncertain about when that collapse point is. So then we have a new problem with our Bell experiment, interpreting our Bell experiments. You can have a situation in which something is happening over here, but maybe it's still at the level of the wave function. The photon's gone through a photomultiplier, but maybe that's just producing correlations in the wave function, and nothing that we should think of as an element of physical reality. And maybe, I realize I'm sort of stretching credulity, but remember our game is to look for loopholes here. Maybe the hypothetical collapse, actually takes place only later, the coincidence counter. So up to here and along here, we still have superpositions of the two possible outcomes here and the two possible outcomes here. And only here do we get a definite single pair of outcomes. Well, if that's true, then all our discussion about this stuff being space-like separated from this stuff, and there being no knowledge about the measurement that took place over here, influencing the possible outcomes over here. All that argument falls apart. If everything is taking place over here, there's no space-like separation at all, and all the information about both measurement choices is there in the uncollapsed wave function here before some outcome is produced. So, what can you do about that? Well, you can at least try to design experiments that give you confidence that collapses actually took place in the two wings of the experiment rather than later on. And here's a very beautiful experiment led by Salar and involving other people from the Geneva group that did exactly that. So their key idea was, let's not be content with running our photons through photomultipliers. We get an electrical signal out from the photomultiplier, and we're going to run that through a piezoelectric crystal. And the properties of these crystals are that they respond quickly and quite dramatically to electric signals, and they deform. So roughly speaking, the crystal compresses this way and goes out that way. And they wanted to check that the thing actually has deformed, so they had a mirror on the end of the crystal and a second, an interference experiment here that effectively measures the distance between that mirror and a beam splitter, and so tells you whether the crystal has or has not stretched. And they did this on a reasonably large scale, 18 kilometers, which is about 60 micro seconds in light speed units, with a pizza crystal over here and another pizza crystal over here. And apart from that, standard Bell experiment. So if you put the numbers together, from the photon entering the detector to producing a response of the crystal, it takes about 6 microseconds. The crystal displaces by about 12 nanometers. The mirror on the end of it is, it's almost, well, it's probably by most people's definition macroscopic. It's 2 milligrams. And you can argue about how conclusively you can be sure that this is a macroscopic outcome, but at least by criteria that are out there in the literature, hand-waving estimates due to Roger Penrose and Laos Joshi, the collapse time for an event that in which you have a superposition of two possible mirror states separated by this distance, given this mass of the mirror, is about 1 microsecond, and we add that to the time from the photons entering the detector, so we get a total of about 7 microseconds, which is an order of magnitude smaller than the separation between the two things.
I'm confused.
Okay.
I don't understand why what the mass of the mirror or the gravity has to do with it. Maybe it's hitting the details of these models, but how is it different from the water wave? I mean, the mirror is just moving with respect to the...
So what would... What we're trying to do here is produce something that we have at least some degree of confidence is a genuine collapse event. So to do that, you have to take somebody's model of what might be collapse, and Penrose and Diossi have models in which two macroscopically distinct gravitational fields, distinguishable gravitational fields in superposition, produce collapses within a certain time.
So some model where the gravitational field profile is different based on the position of the mirror.
Yeah. So this is one. Let me carry on. I think there are reasonable criticisms of this, but I think it's also a beautiful experiment and points the way to further things that can be done. If we take these numbers at face value just for the moment, and assume that Penrose and Jossi are right, and you really must have a collapse within 1 microsecond, then you have definite collapse events in space-like separated regions, and you've shown something stronger than any previous Bell experiment in which it was really unclear when the collapse events took place. And of course, as you expect, the data still agree entirely with quantum mechanics and disagree with local hidden variables, so no surprise there. Where does one go from that? It's a beautiful experiment. It's pushing in the right direction if you really want to close this loophole. It does rely on what in the end are rather ad hoc and hand-wavy models about guessing how gravity and collapse might be connected. We don't have to believe Penrose's or Diossi's calculations or their models. And even if we sort of believe they're roughly right, there's enough hand-waving that they could easily be missing a factor of more than an order of magnitude. And they may not even be roughly right. So perhaps if you want to entertain this line of thought and you really want to close this loophole, you need to push further. And the ultimate goal would have to be something in which you have something that's uncontroversially agreed to be a macroscopic object, a lump of matter. And the separations are large enough that you can actually arrange for this lump of matter to be physically moved to one of several locations over here and a similar one over here in a way that depends deterministically on the random choice of measurement here and the outcome here. So one bit here, 4 possible different locations over here, and another four over here. And I guess people will eventually do an experiment like this, because technologists love a challenge, and because one wants to be as confident as possible that we've understood non-locality in nature. So even when that happens, you get two things. One is you close this loophole completely, and that would be good. And another thing, if you can do it in such a way that you can also directly measure the gravitational field of this lump of matter and complete that measurement in a region in regions that are still space-like separated, is that you'd have direct evidence for quantum correlations in the macroscopic gravitational field in something that we normally think of as classical. So on the one hand, that seems absolutely completely unsurprising. You have a standard Bell experiment, and all you're doing is making classical stuff deterministically depend on details of what you put in and got out from your Bell experiment. You don't expect the correlations to change, and you don't expect the gravitational fields to be anything except what Newtonian gravity tells you they should be as a result of the locations of these things. So every intuition, every fiber of your being as a physicist tells you you think you already know the answer to what will emerge from this experiment. I don't really want to query that. I just want to point out that nonetheless, it does directly conflict with the locality principles of general relativity. It's telling you you should be able to directly observe non-local correlations in the macroscopic gravitational field, and you should be able to measure them. And if you start from GR, which is a local theory, such a thing cannot happen. So we have some way of confirming what it's hard to, and I mentioned this partly because it maybe needs some new insight somewhere. It seems as though we have some way of confirming a little more strongly the quantum nature of gravity, or something about the quantum nature of gravity, in the experiments that don't involve strong gravitational fields or anything beyond Bell experiment and deterministic apparatuses. And that makes me wonder whether there's some subtler way of getting the same evidence without going to all this trouble, but I can't think of one. If anybody can, I'd be excited to hear it. Anyway, I've gone on far too long, so unless there are any questions, thanks very much for your attention, and I'll stop there. Yeah?
There's still not a way in your setup for information to drop quickly.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
So,
yeah.
Do you think it's reasonable that potentially you could slightly alter the way you structure your eyes instead of, say, nothing like that would happen? You specify something like information.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is, GR is a deterministic theory in which everything evolves causally, of course. And there's no way to produce non-local correlations in such a theory. Now, of course, we know GR, quantum theory is there, so GR is not the full story, but this just seems like a rather sharp illustration of a way we can directly see that GR is not the full story. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
Here's something that bugs me. You'd sort of think you're not really doing anything apart from running a Bell experiment. You'd think there should be some way to say, well, okay, I know GR isn't quite right because quantum theory, So there's some sort of, I can just write down some tweaked version of GR which allows for non-local correlations and tells you what happens to the gravitational field in that context. But it's actually really hard to see how where you would start in building, even if you don't think it's a fundamental theory, but a phenomenological one. It's really hard to see how you can build such a thing. There doesn't seem to be any good way to break GR or tweak it so that it has probabilistic outcomes, let alone probabilistic outcomes with non-local correlations. So there's this, yeah, maybe that's all one can say, but there's a sort of sense that somehow this is a, maybe somewhere lurking around here is a different way of probing the tension between GR and quantum mechanics. Maybe not, but I just throw it out as a possibility. I mentioned it partly because of the nature of this meeting and, you know. Dinner time or any other questions?
I have some that might take a far field, but maybe I'll ask
okay.
People who want to escape.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks again.